So let me give you a bit of the backstory to this before I jump into the substance of what I want to share. 7 years ago, God transitioned our family from Southern California to Newington, Connecticut. It would take me the entire hour and 15 minutes and then some to tell you how all that happened and why all that happened and all the providential ways that God put it together. I didn't know anybody in Connecticut. I didn't have any contacts there. I had never even been to Connecticut. And I'd really never heard of Emmanuel Baptist Church. In 2012, Emmanuel, their pastor had resigned. The church had dwindled down to about 120 adults, maybe 130 adults. And at least half of those, when I started having conversations with people, told me they were planning to leave. I have in my bottom drawer of my file cabinet in my office a real estate portfolio where they had already negotiated with a realtor to list the entire church property to sell it. It's about 13 or 14 acres that the building's 1,000-seat auditorium that had been built in the mid-80s. The church at one point in the 70s was running about 800. And they built this big building, and from that moment, from the moment they opened that building, the church declined for 30 years and experienced a lot of really bad leadership, to be honest with you. Immoral leadership, bad financial management, just bad decisions in a lot of respects. And the church got real myopic, like real internalized and very one-dimensional in terms of, you know, a kind of an internalized clubbish kind of thing, and focused on very secondary and tertiary issues and not at all engaged in real gospel ministry. And I want to say all this with respect in terms of there was this core of people at the church that remembered. Most of them were saved in the 70s when the church was really thriving, when it was a gospel-shaped entity. And they held together through all of that decline, through all that, really that bad leadership and those transitions. And so those people that were saved with young families in their 30s, when I came into the picture, they're in their mid-60s and 70s, and their children are all grown, and some of them away from the Lord, some of them not. But those people remained in the church, and I didn't know any of that backstory. But God, through providential series of events, just said, this is where I want you. And it terrified me, honestly. The first time I visited the church property, the parking lot was overgrown with weeds. The building was, all the rooms were filled with junk. I mean, you couldn't even get into some of them. They were just piled high with 35 years of junk. And you know how churches are. They're just clutter magnets, right? You need to get a dumpster on your church property and have work day every quarter just to clear out the junk that people left that they brought on Sundays. It's amazing to me. And all the organs that people donated, all the old, you know. We have an organ. Would you like it? I'm like, no, not another one. We have an old piano. Would you like it? Please, no, don't give us another old piano. So we just got rid of all this stuff, you know. I mean, dumpster after dumpster. Anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself. The church was just, it looked abandoned, okay. And in the conversation of when God put us together in a room, me and the deacons and the pulpit committee, it was a 6-hour conversation. And the first 3 hours, and I kind of went into it kicking and screaming, and there's a long story to that. The first 3 hours, it was me going, these guys are never going to want me because I'm going to change everything. Like, everything but doctrine, I'm going to change. And if it didn't change, if these things didn't change, this church was going to go it was going to go for sale. I mean, they did not have a way to pay the mortgage. And they had a school 1/4 mile away, and they were planning to sell the church property and meet in the school, which would have restricted them to being a church of 100 people, you know. But they would have been sitting on $4 million because they would have gotten, you know, a good bit of money for the property. So it was not a good solution, because coming up across a 1,000-seat auditorium in New England is kind of a rare thing. And even though it was in tragic disrepair and neglect, it needed about $1.5 million worth of work 10 years ago. So my first walk through the building was, please God, don't bring me here. And then I'm sitting in that meeting going, please Lord, don't bring me here. But God's really already said, this is where I want you. And so I kind of, a little bit like Jonah, so, you know, I didn't run, but I was kind of like, I don't want the Ninevites to repent. You know, I'd rather that not happen. So about 3 hours into the conversation with the deacons, they're sitting there thinking, this guy's never going to come here. We don't have much to offer, and he's used to a larger context. And I'm sitting here thinking they would never want me because older churches that are dying just don't want anything to change. That's why they're dying. And about halfway through that conversation, one of the men said, you talk like you're planning to come here. And are you saying you'll come here if we call you? Well, that question was like, it was such a loaded question because I've only known these men for 3 hours. So if I just stand up and if I say, yeah, I'll come, it's the immediate thought on the pulpit committee would be, who did he kill? Who's he running from? What crime is, you know, who's after him? Why would he run to this? So I kind of swallowed and I just said, guys, I don't want to come here. I don't need to come here, but I do feel like God's telling me to come here. And, I know you guys have to do your work and vetting, and you have to look at other candidates if you want to. And there's a whole process to this, and I'm certainly not trying to rush that. But yeah, for whatever reason, God's put on our hearts that this is where he's telling us to come, at least for our side of this equation. Well, when I said that, there's 8 men in the room, and they all looked at each other like they'd seen a ghost. They dropped their jaws, and all of a sudden, they started to laugh and smile. And I'm like, what's going on here, you know? And where we were at this 3 hours of almost cynical posture towards each other, that moment changed everything. And then they started asking me, well, if you come, what would that look like? What would you change? And I just said to these men, do you men even want this church to come back to health? Do you even want it to grow? I figured they would say yes. Who's going to say no to that? You know, but I'm in the back of my mind, my logic is they're going to say yes, but they have no clue what that even looks like, you know? So they're going to say yes, then I'm going to come, and then I'm going to start changing things, and then they're going to vote me out, and it's going to come to a bloody end, and they're going to chew me up and spit me out. Well, they started telling me yes, and I said, man, I don't think you know what that looks like. And I said, with respect, if this church were to get back on its feet and back engaged in gospel ministry, it would soon be infiltrated. You would soon be outnumbered. And you would be outnumbered by people that are tattooed and dreadlocked and that are coming out of fornication relationships and same-sex relationships and every kind of sin problem. Because if we really go about reaching lost people in New England, this church isn't going to look like it's like you. You know, they're not going to, they don't live like you. They don't have your history or your context. They don't speak your language, spiritually speaking. And I said, are you okay with that? I mean, because this is to me like third world, spiritually, like third world ministry. This is New England. It's not Christian culture. And it's going to be brutal. And this isn't going to feel like your church if we do this. And the chairman of the deacons, his name is Charlie, he started to talk. He's about 70, and he got that 70-year-old finger in my face, and he said, let me tell you something. And that perked me up, you know, okay, what's he going to say, you know? He said, I've been in this church for 40 years, almost 40 years at the time. And he said, I gave a good portion of my substance to build this building. And he said, we prayed for 30 years that God would fill this building. And now he gets tears in his eyes. And the other men in the room get tears in their eyes. And he said, from the moment we dedicated this building, the attendance of our church has gone down for 30 years. And now we're talking about selling it. And he said, and we remember when the church was growing. So yes, the answer to your question is yes. We want the tattooed and the dreadlocked and we want the pierced people. We want the people that are not like us. And we are ready for God to bring our church back to life. And we've been praying for 30 years. So yes, you know, cause I said to them, I can't make the church grow. That's God's responsibility, but I just know that healthy things grow. And My goal would be to focus on health, biblical health. And my goal would be to identify ways that we're restraining the gospel and we're hindering the progress, the development that God wants to hinder, that what God wants to bring. And I said, I've only been here for a few hours, but I could tell, I could probably list 20 ways right now without even being in a service yet, how this church is preventing God from drawing people to himself, in just basic ways, just basic internal cultural. This has become a culture unto itself. And this church has long since forgotten how the world outside of it thinks and functions and the language they speak. And so I said, I promise if I were to come here, I wouldn't change doctrine because my doctrine is not for sale. It's not up for negotiation. But pretty much form and style and appearances probably will change. And right now this church is kind of a museum and even a mausoleum. And we need to get back on our feet and get back into ministry, into gospel ministry. Well, that night, God kind of knit our hearts together because they embraced that conversation. And we started conversing then about what would change and trying to contextualize the change. And I mean, I was speaking extemporaneously and throwing ideas out, but I said, guys, I really need to get my feet on the ground and get engaged in people's lives and let the Lord lead. And I said to them that night, the most important thing to me would be that we as a team of men, and I'm very much a team leader, that we as a team of men would let Jesus shape this church and that we would not be beholden to a particular style or movement or external opinions of other people, how they think we should do church, but that we would really, like every meeting and every service, this is the Lord's church. I did not know when I said that what that would entail. And that's 7 years ago now. And what Emmanuel is, and I have no idea if you know anything about our church. We have plenty of critics, I'll tell you that. We probably don't look like your church. I'm not conservative enough for many, and I'm not contemporary enough for many. And when people try to box me in and they ask me, are you progressive or this or that? I go, I reject your categories. I'm just trying to be a first century Book of Acts, gospel shaped local body of believers. And, what I will tell you about what I'm going to teach you the next few moments is that there have been many times that even I had to die to my preference or my opinion of what I thought a church should be because of what I'd been taught or only what I'd seen. And there are many times that God led us to do things or to implement things. Again, nothing theologically, nothing that anybody could make a really biblical case for. Okay. But plenty of people could make an opinionated case for. But plenty of times God's actually rebuked me and said, no, that's not my will for my church in Newington. You know, and things that I've been like, God, is that okay? And God said, yes, that's okay. And this is my church and this is what I want. And this is okay. You know, and I had to be okay with things I was not comfortable with. I could give you lots and lots of illustrations. I'll give you one just to give you the context of what I'm talking about. I've always been taught that the way people get saved, number one is out in the community. So the church goes out to lead them to Christ and then brings them in. I'm not opposed to that, but that's the only model I've ever been taught or seen, okay, for the most part. And then if they want to get saved at church, they walk an aisle. And I'm not opposed to any of this. Please don't. I'm just drawing a contrast, okay? I'm not saying it's right and wrong. I'm just saying there's more than one ways to see God work in people's lives. So you see people walk an aisle, you team up with a counselor, they go back to a counseling room, they're dealt with, they're asked questions, you go through the Romans road, they pray, they get saved, decision card, and then the process unfolds. So that was my program coming into Newington was, how do I get people to walk an aisle, and who can counsel them? And I didn't have counselors, okay? And this was a total replant. This church had very little in the way of operational ministry, okay? I'll never forget the first guy I had lined up for baptism. I said, okay, on Sunday during the invitation, you come forward and we'll baptize you. And so the guy came forward and I turned to one of the deacons. I said, take him back and get him ready for baptism. I'll be there in a minute to baptize him. And the deacon looked at me and goes, there's no water in the baptistry. And I went, oh, you know, and suddenly I'm realizing there's nothing in this church is ready, you know, for anything. So I looked at the guy, I go, we'll baptize you next week. Go back to your seat, you know. So if anybody came forward to be saved, I didn't have anybody to deal with them, you know. And secondly, in New England, walking an aisle to be saved, it's, maybe it would work for you, but I'm not able to get them to walk an aisle. And I didn't even have an opportunity to try because there were lost people from the first service forward in those services. And so from the first Sunday, all I could do was preach the gospel. And then at the end of the service, if you'd like to be saved, here's how to be saved. And then let's have our heads bowed and eyes closed. And if you'd like to pray and ask Jesus to be your savior, do it right now, you know. And a few months of that went by, and I started to say, hey, if you just got saved and you meant it, if you trusted Christ, would you raise your hand? And in the first service, there were a couple hands. In the next service, there were a few hands. In the next service, there were three or four. And then I'd say, hey, come meet me after church and tell me that you got saved so I can get your name, and I'd like to follow up on you. And you know, if three hands went up, two people would come introduce themselves to me, and one would slip out, you know. And so it was this weird, like, am I allowed to do this, you know? And my first meeting with the deacons a few months later, every service somebody had gotten saved. Somebody had raised their hand. And we were following up on most of them, and many of them had started to get baptized. This was all this new. And I'm still not comfortable with this. I'm still thinking, I'm not sure if these people are really saved. You know, because they didn't walk an aisle and go back, and a counselor didn't deal with them, and that way we're sure they're saved, you know. And I walked into the meeting that night and I said, guys, is there anything that you guys are not comfortable with or think I should change? And they just kind of looked at me and just kind of shrugged. And one guy said, well, I know something you shouldn't change. And this was the youngest deacon in the room. He's become a great friend. I know something you shouldn't change. And I'm like, okay, Steve, what should I not change? And he said, do not change the way you're doing the invitation. And that set me back. Because I'm not even comfortable with it. And I said, really? He said, Pastor, I've been in this church for 6 years and I've never seen anybody get saved. And now the last 3 months, there hasn't been a service where somebody didn't get saved. He said, do not change that. And I really had to get alone with God and say, God, is this okay? And God said, have you ever read Acts chapter 2? I mean, you think they had 3,000 counselors and 3,000 counseling rooms and 3,000 packets and decision cards? I mean, really, you know? And so there's 100 stories like that where God had to break down the walls of my comfort zone, okay? Whether it's a song choice or an instrument choice or anything. So let me jump into this. That's a little of the backstory. What God's done over 7 years has been miraculous. He's brought our church back to life. More than half of our church is new believers, first generation believers. He's provided $1.5 million for us to restore the church physically, the property. And it's just a remarkable story. And like I said, I'm not trying to take credit. I'm not the hero. Most days have been depressed or lonely and just, you know, just having to kind of hold together and hold on to Jesus while he does this work. And it's been wonderful to see. First thing I want to say is there's good change and bad change. Okay. And, the Bible says meddle not with them that are given to change. That's the, you know, the poster child verse for everybody that wants to demonize the word change, just demonize the word change, you know. One of the hardest things for Christians to do is to think, you know, and unfortunately we just like to just not think and just slap a verse at something and then reject it. So that's the verse we use. But the Bible also says that we will be changed from into the same image from glory to glory by the Spirit of the Lord. So that's good change, right? Would you say that spiritual transformation, spiritual growth is change? Yes? Okay. A new pastor coming into a church, that's change. I am change, just personified. Like, I'm not the last guy. Okay. So the word change is subjective and it requires a context. And in my context, well, number one, leadership is change. If something doesn't need to change, then leadership is not necessary. And if something isn't changing, then the leader is not leading, okay? If things aren't getting better, if the organization isn't growing towards health, if Christians aren't growing towards maturity, then the leader is not leading, and change is necessary. So leadership is change. I believe that change that changes God's truth or challenges his principles or subverts his authority is always bad change. But change that facilitates his work, elevates his truth, draws us back to the essence of the gospel and good doctrine, that's good change, okay? So just a quick word about change. If you think about this, revival is change, repentance is change, redemption is change, and all that's healthy change, okay? The Bible's filled with change-oriented leaders. Joshua, Nehemiah, Jesus, I mean, we could go through. The Bible's replete with leaders that stepped in and brought about radical change, radical revival or revitalization. So it's important that we don't thoughtlessly demonize change. It's important that we discern it, okay? The second kind of introductory thought I want to say is when you come into a change, needful environment as a leader, there is immediately a tension, this tension that you are going to manage between what is and what could be, okay? And it's important that we consider this because leaders are to be visionary, okay? And that means you get out on the horizon and you chart, you understand God's journey that he wants these people to go on individually and corporately as a church. And you begin to understand it, then you come back and you lead forward. Even though really Christ is the leader, you're the under shepherd following Christ, and it's a beautiful picture. And you want to make sure you're following Christ. That's the essence of it. But at the end of the day, if you're the leader, he's appointed you to lead forward. Okay. And so as a leader, if you get too far out into what could be, that tends towards tyranny. It tends toward discontentment. In other words, you tend to steamroll over and trample over good hearts and good people and good things that already are, okay? In a thirst, in a hunger, in this panting passion, which can become a personal, privatized agenda and kind of an identity thing that you're just driving to feel better about yourself. And so you're steamrolling over people. So the leader needs an idea of what could be, and he needs to be pulled forward towards what could be. There needs to be this healthy dissatisfaction, okay, but not a discontentment, not something that crosses the line of biblical bounds of in whatsoever state I am therewith I will be content, okay? And I admit there's this struggle all the time in my heart, you know, between really being thrilled and content with what God's doing in our church. And I just want to, can I pause and say here, if you pastor 5 people, you pastor something really special. If you pastor 50 people or 150 people, that is really special. And if you're not really happy with the privilege of pastoring 5 people, then you won't be happy when you have 50. And 100 won't make you happy, and 200 won't make you happy, and 300 won't make you. If the numbers game is a total game, because you're never really happy, okay? Because as soon as you get to 200, you're like, oh yay, 200. Now we gotta go to 3. And you can just game yourself forward and not realizing it, trample over people, both lay people and staff, in trying to get to where you have this stable identity because of your accomplishments and your achievements. And it really is a deceptive game. And it's hurtful to God's people. And it's hurtful to God's church. So the danger of being drawn too passionately towards what could be means you break God's church. Okay? But the other side of that, to swing the pendulum to the other side of the spectrum, you can also get too complacent with what is and not lead and not have a vision and nothing's changing. In fact, things are deteriorating and have this, well, if God, you know, God will do whatever God wants to do and not actually engage as a leader. And then under your leadership, things just deteriorate. And that's passivity. So let me just say this. What is now is reality. It's present. It's all you really have. And that makes it really special. And God says, he that is faithful in that which is least is faithful also in much. And so Don't despise now, okay? In thirst of what could be, don't despise now, okay? What could be, what is special, what could be is special. But what could be can make you discontent and wrestle over what is and resent what is. So there's this tension of leading forward while you appreciate what is, but leading towards what could be. And wise leaders will work hard to manage that tension. And I think personally it is an emotional soul tension, okay? Honoring and appreciating what is, but then saying, but God doesn't want us to stay here. He wants us to go forward. And one of the phrases I've used with our older members, because they have tended at times over the last 7 years to feel, and I knew they would, okay, as the church goes forward, that they've lost what was, you know. And what I've had to help them see is, no, we're building on what was. Their 35 and 45 years of faithfulness is what we're standing on. It's not as visible as it used to be. It's not as memorialized on the church walls and hallways, but it very much is the foundation that we're standing on. I tell our 70 and 80 year old members all the time, I'm standing on your shoulders. 40, 50, 60 years of faithfulness is what I'm standing on. We wouldn't have this building and this privilege and this opportunity for the next generation if it weren't for your faithfulness. But I've had to help them where they had kind of become a museum of what was. I had to help them get a vision for the next generation. Okay, we'll talk about how in a few minutes. So this tension is powerful and risky. Being pulled too far in one direction makes you agitated and rushed, and pushing too fast for change, it makes you too aggressive and burdened and self-sufficient. It causes you to steamroll over people. It causes you to be forever dissatisfied and ungrateful. And you'll miss the little victories, the significance of today's victories, and the seeds you're planting for tomorrow's. And I don't think this is leadership. I think it's tyranny, okay? But being pulled, I'm going to read this, and forgive me for reading it, but being pulled too far in the direction of what is will make you lethargic and apathetic and lazy. It will demotivate you. You'll just settle. It will enlarge the obstacles. It'll be everything's impossible. You'll sit on your hands. You'll do nothing. You won't have any vision. And that's not servant leadership. It's passivity. Okay. So the key here is to love what is, but to love the church and the people enough to help them go to where God wants them to be. Okay. And that's where this becomes an art biblically and spiritually. It's a diplomatic art of leading a church out of lethargy into health. Okay. Last thing I want to say before I'm going to give you my main points. Ultimately, leading spiritual change is not something that we can fabricate. It's something that God orchestrates and we participate in it. Okay. I don't think you can really preach the gospel and preach the Bible without change kind of materializing. Okay. And everybody who is in sync with God's spirit working in the church kind of comes to that unity of this is what God is doing. I could tell you a million stories, but the beauty of the change is I have not had to fight one battle for change. The change that God has brought has materialized almost organically, and we almost all came to the same realizations at the same times. And we went forward together. And in that, God's really orchestrated beautiful unity. Okay. So, here are my stages that I've seen God unpack in our world. Okay. Number one, to lead healthy change, you must first build authentic relationships. Okay. Build authentic relationships. If I am losing, I had a conversation with a guy one time where he sat down with me, and for an hour, he talked about he had been the pastor of his church for 2 years, and the church had gone from 200 down to about 80 people. And he was glorying in this purging backdoor revival, you know. He was so happy all these people were gone. He had won all these fights. And I'm hearing him, and he's thinking I'm impressed that he asserted his pastoral authority and that he won all these fights and he told these people. And I'm thinking, you're like the king of the mountain, but you're the only one there now. You know, it's like, You've lost so much in winning so little. You know, you have established your pastoral authority, which is so overrated, and you've lost the privilege of ministering to all these people that had you won their hearts and built a relationship with, you probably could have spared the loss of the relationships. Now, that said, I've had my own losses, okay? But it wasn't losses that I gloried in. It wasn't losses that were born out of fights. And it wasn't losses that I didn't try to sit down and lovingly preserve and protect those relationships. So here's what I believe about healthy change. It is for God's people. So I guess the first question is, why do you want change in your ministry? I talk to a lot of younger leaders. They want change because they want the church to be cool. Or they want it to be updated, or they want it to be trendy, or they want it to be in some way culturally, and I'm not opposed to this word, relevance, but that's such a, again, a very subjective word. It means a million different things to a million different people, and it's fun to just throw it out there and preach against it without defining it, without putting up any boundaries and setting up categories. So I think it's important that you vet your heart, like what am I really trying to accomplish? And what I'm trying to accomplish is when lost secular New Englanders who have never heard the gospel, they think Christianity equals Catholicism. Okay? That's the only category they have in their mind. And most of them have never, the non-Catholics have never heard a gospel presentation. We're having to teach people about Adam and Eve and the fall and, I mean, just basic stuff. So I'm trying to win them to Christ, and then I'm trying to build, to shape believers as devoted disciples and after the image of Christ, and ground them and root them in Jesus Christ. And so whatever change I'm implementing, that's the end goal of the change. It's not to be impressive. It's not to have an impressive church or to be notable or something like that. The change we're implementing is for these people. So if I'm running over them and losing them in the process, something's wrong, okay? At least if I'm losing most of them or many of them, something's wrong. I could be doing this differently. Some of you may have heard this before, but there's an Aesop's fable about a contest between the wind and the sun. And the wind and the sun decided to have a contest to see who could make a man remove his winter coat. As a child, well, I'm quoting this from a blog post that I read, and I do not remember the source or the author of the blog post, but it was a tremendous article. So thinking about this fable, you would expect the wind's power to obviously win the contest, that the wind can blow the man's coat off. And the sun, what power does the sun have to force a person, you know, a person's coat to be removed? So, the wind takes his turn first, and the wind blows and blows and blusters. And the more the wind blusters, the more the man grasps his coat, okay? So the blustering wind only made the man cling more tightly to his coat. Well, finally, the wind gives up and says, I tried and can't blow this man's coat off. It's the sun's turn. So the sun comes out and beams warmly and gently on the man, gradually warming him. And finally, just in the warmth and the sun, in the presence of the sun, you know what happens. The man takes his coat off freely and voluntarily. The sun created an environment that helped the man make his own choice to take his coat off. And honestly, I could stop right there, because I really believe that the Spirit of God and the Word of God will create that environment. If you're preaching it textually, contextually, expositionally, if you're not adding to what it says, if you're not shaping it in a denominational way, if you're just, we've spent 2 years through the Gospel of Luke and a year and a half through Acts. We're in Acts 27 on Sunday. And we're just one section after another. And I could go through a whole battery of schedule and structural changes we've made in the last 6 months that God shaped in us in the previous year. Just doing an expositional study of Acts 1 through about 13. He showed us what he does in a church, how he shapes it. And All I can tell you is the change that's materialized at Emmanuel has been healthy, and it's been willing. It's been changes that the church embraced. Why? I think because my goal was not to force change. My goal was to love them to the Word of God, to help them think biblically, and the church has then grown into the change. Okay. Let me say this. The first and most common deterrent to people accepting healthy change, and you guys understand that's what I'm talking about, right? Healthy change, okay? Cooperating with it is really trust, a trust factor, okay? And like a new pastor doesn't have any trust, which was really difficult for me because I came from a ministry with 22 years of trust. And I'm now I have no trust, and I'm actually underwater because a series of pastoral transitions has caused the office of pastor to be highly suspicious. So now I'm just the next jerk that's going to hurt them. That's the way they view me. So I went from having a positive balance of trust to having a negative deficit of trust through no fault. I had people angry at me on day one just because I was pastor at Emmanuel. And Emmanuel had a bad name in the community, and people all over that region that had formerly gone to that church that had been hurt or abused or whatever. And so now they're mad at me. And I'm like, it was like they all had PTSD, and I'm the guy, just because I carry the name Emmanuel and pastor, I'm the new guy that's touching the raw nerve in their life. And they're coming unloaded on me. And I'm like, whoa, I just moved here from California. I know nothing. You know, I have no, but I'm responsible all of a sudden. So I had this negative deficit of trust. And honestly, there were a lot of days I just went to Dunkin' Donuts and moped. Like, God, why'd you do this to me? This is not fair. This isn't right. And, you know, I had a good life and you stripped me of it. And now these people hate me. And it really didn't seem right. And God said, just love them. Just love them and lead and preach the gospel. And so gaining trust, earning trust, was a big part of having relationships where people would follow. Okay, I guess my point here, pastoral credibility is far more important than pastoral authority. Okay, biblical authority, there's a real strong case for. My authority starts and stops with the Bible. Okay. What I need more than authority is credibility. Authority makes me wind blustering, okay? Credibility makes me the sun shining. And what I've found is people, if they're loved, and they know you love them, and they know you're committed to true biblical doctrine, then they'll let you lead them. They'll grow in trust. And my thinking is, if I leave people in the dust, or if I lose them in droves, I'm not leading well. I'm blustering wind and leveraging authority, but I'm not leading biblically the way that God's sheep would willingly follow. Okay. So what I tried to do was love people, and I tried to feel their fears. There's one lady in the church that was angry at me for 5 years. Just angry for no reason. And I finally, we had, always these interactions where she didn't like anything about me. And, I said to her one day, her name's Marianne. I said, Marianne, I know you don't like me, but I still love you. And I don't care how long it takes me. You haven't left the church yet. And as long as you don't leave the church, if it takes me the rest of my natural life to prove to you that I love you, before I die, before you die, one of us, you're going to know that I love you unconditionally, no matter how mean you are to me. And we finally had a sit-down appointment where I said, Marianne, you got hurt in your past somewhere. Believe me, I wanted to, like, tell her how wrong she was. And she was, frankly, very hurtful at times. And I looked at her in this meeting. I said, Marianne, your former pastors have hurt you, and you take that out on me. Or somebody in your life has hurt you, and you take that out on me. And I said, I get it, and I forgive you. Because I'm just going to prove to you that not everybody's going to hurt you. And she broke. This is like 4 years of abuse I've taken, you know, and she breaks in this meeting. And I had one of our other pastoral staff sitting there, and she began to weep. And she said, every pastor I've ever had has hurt me. And she said, to go a step further, pastor, she said, every man in my life, her husband abandoned her. She raised her children as a nurse, single mom. She said, every man in my life ever has hurt me. And I said, well, Marianne, I'm not all those men. And I said, I hope to show you at least one that's going to love you as a church. You know, you get what I'm saying, appropriately. And, you know, and she's actually one of my most ardent supporters right now. I mean, like one of the most gracious, you know, I won her. And that was like the biggest victory in the last 7 years to me. Like, if I can win Marianne, there's no mountain we can't scale together, you know. So I guess my point is, I think that's how a shepherd should be, okay? So to start with, leading change is not about steamrolling over people. I'm not one to disparage people, even people that aren't like me, okay, in public context like this. I take the idea that I've learned a lot from people that I disagree with in a lot of areas, okay? I disagree with, say, like Rick Warren in a lot of areas, okay? Not to say I can't learn something from him, but I think somewhere in his model, he published at some point an article about just kind of telling the old people to go to another church or just kind of push them aside. And I really hate that, because I think they can be led to accept healthy change. I think they can be loved there. At least that's what's happened at Emmanuel. Okay. If the change you're leading leaves people behind, then I would say it probably wasn't healthy change. Now that said, you're not going to take everybody, because some people you're just not going to be able to convince, no matter how biblically you articulate the argument. And so there is a place where you're going to have to be willing to take the shots. Okay? Let's move on to point two, and I'm running out of time. So point two is communicate obsessively and incessantly. So after building authentic relationships, loving God's sheep, caring for them, really pouring yourself out for them, I think change rests on how you communicate. And so I put down the words obsessively and incessantly, and I would say communicate biblically and communicate optimistically, with vision and with a joyful heart. I think of Ronald Reagan. We know him as the great communicator. I miss him as president, because he was, if you remember, he just inspired the nation. I mean, and he just did it with a smile. And I believe biblical leaders help people, this is very important, to contextualize change and ministry development. Let me give you an example. Philippians chapter 1, Paul is in a prison. It's at the end of his ministry. He's writing back to Philippi. And real suffering and oppression is about to unfold on the New Testament church. And in some degree already is. And the Philippian Christians, you know, that the theme of that letter is joy and confidence, and that they would be rejoicing through suffering, okay? That they would not lose their confidence. And he's worried about them, and they're worried about him. This is interesting dynamic. And he says to them in chapter 1, I would that you should understand, brethren, the things which happened unto me have fallen out rather unto the furtherance of the gospel. And he begins to expound how even in Nero's palace, people are coming to Christ. And even his enemies, his detractors, because of him, are preaching the gospel more. And he rejoices that Christ is preached. But here's the thing I want you to understand. Here's a guy in prison, in Rome, thinking about his church in Philippi. And he's worried about their emotions and their confidence. And he's going to write them a letter for the very purpose of helping them to contextualize his suffering. I would that you would understand, brethren, the things which happened to me. Do you get that? He's sitting there going, the Philippians are worried about me. I'm okay, because people are getting saved in Nero's palace, but they're worried about me. They don't know that God's at work here, and they're going to lose their confidence. So I'm going to write them a letter to help them respond right emotionally and psychologically and spiritually to my suffering. Now, think of that from the heart of a leader. He's not saying, feel sorry for me, self-pity me, you know, poor pitiful me. Okay, I know leaders that their whole leadership style is based on self-pity. Okay. He's not only not pitying himself, he is expressly not wanting them to pity him. And he is, as a leader, helping them to frame their response to what's going on in his life. Now, what does that teach me about leadership? It teaches me that a leader seeks to understand the emotions of those he leads and to help them place their emotions where they need to be. Let me give you a simple example. An older man in my church named Ron. He came to the church about a year after I got there. He was saved at a Billy Graham crusade back in the 60s. He was saved out of homosexuality. Ron now is in heaven. He passed away this past year. But for the past 5 years, one of my dearest friends and encouragers and one of the most positive, supportive men in the church. Well, we were remodeling the whole front of our church and really the whole inside of the auditorium we were renovating, which was about a $350,000 project. But the platform, we were doing some stonework and some woodwork, and we wanted to make it beautiful, not ostentatious, but beautiful. We were doing it very cost effectively. And I walked into church one day. I was headed to the back. I was preparing to preach just about 15 minutes before the service. The adult groups had not let out yet, so the auditorium was relatively empty. Ron was kind of sitting there by himself, and I kind of breezed by him. "Hey, Ron, how you doing?" And he goes, "Pastor," and he kind of put a finger up, and I walked over, and he had the prayer card, which they fill out and put in the offering plate. And he said, I just want you to know, Pastor, I have some concerns, and I wrote them on the prayer card, and I'm going to put that in the offering this morning. Just when you get the card, you'll know it's from me. Well, that's really what you want to hear right before you preach, right? It's just what. So now I have a choice. First of all, my insecurities rise up, and I'm instantly, you know, emotionally responding, which is, we have got to become self-aware of that, okay? I'm already having an emotional, I don't even know what his concerns are. Maybe his concern is, are you getting enough rest? You know, I'm just automatically making it negative. I'm all automatically prickly. And God's Spirit gave me a moment of clarity, like, catch your breath, you know, Ron's a great guy, he loves you, he loves the church, he's not divisive. And I thought, I can let this stew in the back of my mind for the next hour and a half, even through my message, wondering what Ron's card's going to say, and then get home and be like, sort through the cards and find Ron's card, you know. Or, you know, I've got 15 minutes, I could just stop and talk to Ron. And God's Spirit just kind of put on my heart, just sit down. And I go, "Hey," I go, "Ron, you know what? You're my friend." I sat down with him. I said, "What? Just talk to me right now. What's going on? What are you worried about?" He goes, "No, I don't want to distract you before you preach." I'm like, "Ron, mission failure there. Okay, you've already pretty well distracted me." I said, "I'm gonna wander my whole message. So you might as well just tell me." I said, "No, Ron, we're friends." I said, "Tell me what." I have a deacon again, Steve. Steve's one of my best friends now. That told me this. He said, "Pastor, whenever you get in these prickly situations, here's a magic bullet, magic question." I said, "Really, a magic question?" He said, "I'm telling you, it diffuses every situation." I said, "Then tell me that question." He said, "Just very calmly look at the person and smile and say, 'Help me understand what is your greatest concern.'" Now, if that's all you heard me say, I'm telling you, that can change your life, okay? Don't get upset. Don't get emotional. Just help me understand what's your greatest concern. That question has diffused probably more than 100 situations for me in the last 7 years. So I said to Ron, "Tell me, Ron, what's your concern?" And I smiled at him. He said, "Well, Pastor, you know, we're raising money and we're giving." And he said, "I don't know, just the stone and the tile and the woodwork. It seems like we're spending so much money. Do we have to spend all that money? It's so expensive." I said, "Oh, Ron, you and I think just alike." I said, "I have the same concern." And he goes, "You do?" So now he's even relieved. I said, "Oh my goodness, yes, absolutely." I said, "Well, let me tell you something, Ron. Number one, it's not real stone. It's fabricated. It looks real, but it's fabricated." "Oh, it isn't?" I said, "Yeah, it's like way cheaper than a real stone." "Oh," I said, "and it's not real wood. It's laminate. It looks real from the floor, but it's not real." He goes, "It's not real?" "Oh," and I was, you know, relieving sighs. And I said, "And the tile, we're just doing one row of tile. It's just decorative. And then we're carpeting the rest." I said, "Ron, we are doing this incredibly economically, and the contractor is giving us an amazing deal." I said, "We've really researched this." I said, "But the other side of this, Ron, is," I said, "this is the backdrop for the preaching of the gospel of Jesus. And we want it to focus attention on the word of God, and we want it to be well done." He goes, "Oh, I agree. We want it to be well done." And he smiled at me. He goes, man, that just puts me at rest. He goes, you know what? He takes his card and tears it up. I won't even turn my question in. He goes, you've totally resolved my concerns. It didn't take me 5 minutes. And I shook his hand. He hugged me and I left. Just learning how to understand their emotions and then learning how to help them put their emotions in the right place. Let me help you know how to respond to that. Let me help you know how to think about that. I'll give you another quick illustration. We've introduced a lot of new songs. We might sing songs you would never sing at your church. You know what? Back at you. You probably sing songs I would never sing at my church. So let's just agree to disagree and let's get back to gospel ministry. But what I've said to our church family is we want to be a multi-generational church. Well, everybody gets that. You know, we want old and young. And then I said, a very selfish thing for any generation to do is to tell every other generation, you can only sing the songs I like. I said, for any generation, that's really selfish. And I actually preached a message one time where I've done this twice. I brought up all the, you know, under 40 people to the platform. The first time I did this, there was about maybe 30 of them. And then the second time I did this, there was probably 250 of them, you know. And it was really exciting. But they got up on the platform behind me, and I looked out to the older folks, you know, the over 40, the real old people. And I looked at them, I said, you know what's going to happen to all of us? And I had just come through a cancer battle at the time, and I said, you know what's going to happen to all of us? I said, we're going to die. And I said, I'm not trying to be morbid, but we're going to die. And they're going to lead the church forward. This generation behind me, this is going to be their church. And I said, we're trying to hand off the faith once delivered to the saints, to them. And I said, some of you, your heart comes to life when we sing, how firm a foundation. I said, because you were saved in the 50s or the 60s. And some of you were saved in the 60s or 70s, and you go back to the Gaither area. So your heart comes to life when we sing, there's a lighthouse on the hillside. And some of you grew up in the Steve Green era in the 80s, and your heart comes to life when we sing, oh, may all who come behind us find us faithful, or people need the Lord. Now, I remember when they preached against people need the Lord. Now it's a classic, you know, and it's acceptable everywhere. And my kids can't fathom a time when anybody would have preached against people need the Lord. You know, like, really? What were you thinking? You know, it's funny how generationally we view these things. And then I said, and now there's some of you in the room that your heart comes to life when we sing, bless the Lord, oh my soul, oh, and 10,000 reasons, you know. And I looked at the congregation, I said, and what we ought to do is appreciate all of them. If they're biblically substantive, if they carry doctrine from one generation to the next, we should love it all. And I said, if we're going to love every generation, we're going to blend that and be a healthy church. That was a bit of a rabbit trail, but communicating, okay? You can't presume that people know what you think. You can't assume they understand you. You have to communicate and you have to understand their emotions and help them to place their emotions. Those are my big two points. Let me drive the last few home, and then we'll take about 15 minutes for questions, okay? Number three, enlist leaders to your team that share your vision. I think to lead change, first you just build relationships so people learn to trust you, okay? By the way, the only way to speed up trust is sacrifice, okay? If I don't know you and I was standing next to you in an intersection and your child stepped out in front of a bus and I jumped in front of the bus and threw your child to safety, but I was permanently injured because of that, even if you didn't know me, you would really esteem and respect me and trust me. All of a sudden, trust, even though you don't know me. Why? Because I made a huge sacrifice for you, okay? So one way to gain trust is to sacrifice for people. When they see that you sacrifice, they trust you faster. So if you want to speed up trust, that's one way to do it. Number three, enlist leaders. So I'm coming back to point three. You need people on your team that share your vision that can help others to get it. And that's what God gave me in the deacons there that night. And as the church went forward in Emmanuel, they knew my heart of commitment to doctrine. They knew we would reason through the right kind of changes at the right pace at the right time. They knew I was going to lead with a consensus. And so they became my team And the old men have communicated to the older people, and the young men have communicated to the younger people, and it's been a very much a team effort, so it hasn't been me out on a limb by myself. This team, number one, was God's idea, plurality of leadership. Secondly, it lends credibility to your vision. Thirdly, it protects you from being isolated or narcissistic or just doing things according to your agenda. Fourthly, it gives you the right kind of accountability, the right kind of support. And I will just tell you that the change God's implemented in our church the last year has really been because of a godly team of men that have gotten on our knees together and said, God, lead us. And it's been amazing how he has. Number four, very quickly, I want to challenge you to run towards the problems and graciously resolve them, okay? And I told you the story already of Ron, and that's what I'm talking about. Go to the Marianne's, go to the Ron's, and not to lecture them or to assert your authority over them like blustering wind, but to warm them like the sun. You'll be amazed how when you really love people, their hearts will come towards you, okay? And that question, what is your greatest concern? Very, very powerful. Number five, teach your team to run to and solve problems as well. Run to and solve problems. So my goal is kind of an Acts 6 goal, okay, where there's going to be problems in the church. There's going to be where we bump into each other. We miss cue on things and people get neglected or forgotten or needs don't all get met. As the church develops, as we're implementing healthy change, there's going to be some clunkiness to it. And I just stand up to the church. I just admit that. I say, hey, we are growing into ourselves. And so we want to hear from you. If we're missing something, please come to one of our leaders. We want to be approachable. What I love about the Acts 6 model is the leaders were approachable. They didn't just, the murmuring was not appropriate, but some wise person caught wind of the murmuring and went to leaders with the right motive, not just to say those people are murmuring. You know, they didn't have to have a contentious meeting to excommunicate the murmurers. They actually validated the murmurers at the root, like this is a legitimate problem and we need to resolve it. And the team appointed another team. And the primary purpose of those leaders was to mitigate needs and to resolve problems. Okay. So I've told our team leaders, listen, if you're a deacon, if you're a pastor, if you're a leader, a group leader in our church, one of your primary roles is to help resolve problems. To help bring people together where they can reconcile, where they can repair what's broken, and where we can go forward in unity. So healthy change requires not only a problem-solving leader, but a leader that's building a problem-solving team, okay? And this is where great teams really shine, because you're constantly shepherding people and resolving problems, okay? Number six, and we're done, you need to protect your heart and cultivate your own emotional health through this. Church revitalization is really what I'm getting at. And it is a treacherous journey. Okay. And it requires a lot of spiritual battle. And there's a lot of loneliness. There's a lot of raw emotion and dark days. And I can tell you that personally for me, that's why I know it's not me that's produced the change, because I know myself and I know how weak I am. And I know how many mornings I've just like resigned, like I can't do this. And then, you know, I get alone with God and God kind of puts it back together in my own heart. And every day of the week, Satan jumps onto my shoulder and says, God's not doing anything in this church. You might as well quit now. And then every Sunday, God reminds me that he is. And so it is, I will tell you this, it's the most emotionally treacherous ground I've ever walked the last 7 years. And prior to that, I went through cancer for a year, so that maybe that gives you some context. So your own spiritual health and emotional health is critical to that. Why is that? I just believe that leaders create a culture. Leaders create an environment. The spirit of the leader becomes the culture. If you have a toxic environment, it's after 3, 4, 5 years of your leadership, if the environment is caustic and toxic, it's probably because you are. If it's contentious, it's probably because you are. If it's angry, it's probably because you are. The church body culture becomes a kind of a mirror of reflection of what they've been fed. You know, the attitude of the pastor kind of shows up in the church. Contentious pastors tend to attract contentious people, and then they claim to be the victim of these unruly sheep. And really, the sheep are reflecting the attitude of the pastor. So if you're emotionally unhealthy, you're going to produce the same thing. You can't help but do that. You'll just create a culture there, okay? I have talked, at least by my clock here, for 1 hour and 5 minutes, which means we should have about 10 minutes left. Does anybody have a question or a comment to throw into this? I'll finish with this. The reason change has been effective at Emmanuel is it's not me against them. It's us following Jesus. And that's the context of the change. And every bit of the change has drawn us back to the Word of God, back to doctrine, back to gospel ministry. And for that way, it's been healthy. Questions or comments? Yes, sir.
So when you, it's a two-part question.
Okay.
When you arrived at Emmanuel, what was the state of the youth program? And as your church has grown, how has the older generation embraced the youth, and kind of what role has the youth pastor had with the progress of the church?
There were no junior hires, because my daughter was 12 and there were no kids her age in the church. And there were a handful of senior hires, maybe 8 or 10. So there was very little youth ministry. The former youth pastor had resigned and moved away. He was only part-time. Today on Wednesday night youth group, they probably have 80 or 90 kids. And there's a group of about 6 adults that work that. And it just so happens, and I couldn't have orchestrated this, but my son Lance leads our worship and does youth. And, We're really just focusing on teaching them the Bible. You know, we have a pretty simple program. They do an activity a month or so, and we're not trying to entertain them. We're trying to build them as followers of Christ. And same thing, if you saw my youth, you'd probably go, wow, they're raw. Again, half my church is raw. They're just new Christians, you know. So we actually have, this year, we will have the first 2 graduates of our youth group go into ministry of the last 7 years. So I'm pretty excited about that. You know, took 7 years, but there's progress, you know. And the families that are coming into the church now, the youth group now, they've kind of been through children's ministry, and so we're about to see some good fruit in the youth ministry, but it takes time. I don't know if that answers your question, but in brief, that's the best answer I can give. Anybody else? Yes, sir.
When you went to the church, did you have people that were kind of expecting change right off the bat, and they were like gung-ho for it, and then some people were like, back off, slow down? Because I just took over a pastor, and right off the bat, people were like, oh, we're really excited, we want this. Like, hold on, you know.
It was both.
Okay.
It was both.
How did you navigate that?
Ooh. Well, it goes back to relationships. There's an article on my blog called Three Priorities for a New Pastor. And this was born out of, I came into a church, it's like, this church needs $1.5 million worth of work now, and we are going over a cliff fast. We were bleeding money, $5,000 a week, $20,000 negative a month cash flow. Think about that, $20,000 negative cash flow a month. And we had 6 months of savings. So six months from the day I got on site, we are out of money, okay? And I freaked out when I realized, I didn't know that prior to going there. Cause I told the deacons, they wanted to tell me all this stuff. And I'm like, don't tell me. It'll scare me away. I said, I just want to know that God's in this. If you tell me the problems, I'll run for my life and I don't want to run. So we were in a desperate situation. That was a blessing. Okay. Now, right now I say that. Then I didn't say it because it was like every week nail biter. Am I going to get a paycheck? And I was about to go on deputation for support. If you had asked me to do a funeral for your cat, if there was a love offering involved, I would have done a funeral for your cat. Cause I was buying groceries. I mean, I literally, they weren't paying me enough to live off of. So there was this, most of the church was like, we were going to leave, but since you're coming, we're going to stay and we are ready, you know, so it couldn't change fast enough for them. The older, longtime folks, like, I was ripping down every display. I was tearing up carpet. I was, like, demolishing the place. And they felt, I could see it in their faces. They felt this twinge of, we're losing our memories. And I just had to commiserate with them. You know, we had this day where we left the auditorium and I said, go rip down the wallpaper in the lobby. And I gave them Sharpies and I said, write a verse and a prayer on the wall where the wallpaper was, because we're gonna paint, you know. And as they're going out there, I mean, the young people and the kids, they're shredding the place. And these old people are like, our church, you know. And I said, I know this is painful for some of you. I said, but look forward. We're building on your legacy, you know. And dream with me for the next generation. Let's leave this church healthy. And they caught that. What I would say with the change resistors, it's kind of two layers. There's some that they've just been taught a style of ministry and they've equated that with doctrine. And they're not thinking. Those people are the hardest to deal with, okay? Because, you know, they think it's a sin not to preach in a suit and tie. So I have to retrain them theologically. And a handful of those are who I lost, okay? The other people that are resistant to change is just emotional. They don't have a reason. They're just sad. It's painful. And if you'll just understand the pain, then they'll come to you, you know? So the non-thinkers, you have to reteach. And those that are emotional, you have to commiserate and then lovingly lead. Okay. So, okay. I saw another hand. Yes, sir.
My following pastor has been there for 30 plus years. And he told me, Luke, it's going to be 2 years before you become the true pastor of the church. So you need to take it slow. And I've tried to change a few things. And of course, a few things I've kind of like, I should have waited on that one. How long did it take you to kind of become the pastor, or did you just implement these concepts and change?
It's a moving thing. So it's a dynamic that, you know, there was this dynamic on day one that everybody was really glad that I came because they didn't think anybody would want to come, but nobody trusted me. So go figure, you know, we're really glad you're here, but we do not trust you, you know? And we're a little bit ticked off at you at the same time, you know, because you're a pastor and we don't like pastors. So you know, we love you, we hate you, and it's all that mixed up. I would say that the church was in a desperate enough place that they kind of had to trust me. That's why it was a gift. The desperate situation was a gift. You know, like I went to the deacons, I needed money for follow-up. And by follow-up, I needed to be able to spend money at Panera Bread, sitting down with a family and leading them to Christ. Well, we didn't have the money, you know. And we're burning through savings at a rapid pace. So I did the math and I'm like, if they gave me $1,000 a month for follow-up, that's $6,000 over the next 6 months, which means we die 1 week sooner, you know. So I sat down with them and said, guys, I need $1,000 a month for follow-up. And worst case, we're already in flames going over a cliff. Okay, so all this means is we just like, we light the other half of the wagon on fire as we go over, you know. That's the worst that happens. We die 1 week sooner. But I said on the flip side, if we hope to save this situation, I have got to see immediate fruit and I've got to have resources to sit down and follow up with people. And so, that they trusted me, you know, and they said, yeah, well, you know, so they kind of had to. I would say, 2-3 years in, there was much more trust, and now 7 years in, it's almost not even a question, you know. So yeah, time and sacrificial love, and people just seeing. I don't think I've perfected humility, but just standing up and saying, I don't know what I'm doing, but I'm trusting Jesus and I'm following Him, and I really do love you, has gone a long ways with them. And thank you for giving me a chance. Thank you for being patient with me. Thank you for forgiving me, you know, giving me time to grow. All those statements, when you're coming in and standing on someone else's shoulders, go a long ways with people. So that's my quick advice. Yes, sir.
You can just think of just a few little short things about leading your family from a healthy to an unhealthy change or whatever. Here you are, you're talking about your little girl, the only person, you know, in this part of this section of the ministry, and trying to lead your family through that. Any kind of just specific one of those?
Our first 8 months were exceedingly painful for our family. My son Larry had just graduated from high school. He was starting first year of college, and he struggled a lot because he was at West Coast, but that was no longer home. You remember this, Dr. R. And suddenly he was totally disoriented because mom and dad live across the country. That was painful. Our 12-year-old daughter, I thought I was going to lose her. I mean, just every day was a fight. I took a long walk with God one night. I cried. I said, God, I obeyed you to come here, but I don't think you brought me here to wreck my family, you know. And I said, I need help, you know, to know how to help them. And I think that was an important moment. I sat down with them about 6 or 8 months in. At that point, Larry was home and Haley was home. I'll try to make this quick. I know we're going to lunch. I said to them, guys, I've been tense. I'm operating in a lot of fear. I don't know if this is going to work. I'm scared out of my mind right now. This is 6 months in, you know. And I said, and you guys have been totally displaced. Haley went from a junior high of 200 kids to a junior high of no kids. Dana, my wife, was the one that had the most sound mind. And I think it was because she watched me go. She navigated our family through cancer. So she was already in this survival mode. Like, you know, she was like a, like Rambo wife, you know, and she just kind of kept that on knowing that I was losing my mind and the kids were losing their minds. And, so it was remarkable, her grace. She never lost confidence that God was doing this and he was going to use me to do it. Meanwhile, the whole time I'm going, I can't do this and I'm the wrong guy. So, but we sat on one night and I just looked at Larry and Haley and I said, guys, I know how you feel because I resisted this for a year before we moved. And I said, and now that we've moved, you guys have resisted this for 8 months. And I said, I know the only peace in my heart, the only hope for peace came when I surrendered to God. And I said, I know with you, the only hope for peace, it's not you and me against each other. This is you against God. And I said, I've tried to help you, but that the only hope is that you surrender to God. And I said, I can't force you. And I'm tired of arguing with you and I'm tired of the tension in the family. So I give. And I'm like, I don't know what to do. I said, but I think you two love God. And they're like, yeah, we do. And I said, so let me ask you a question. 8 months ago, did I obey God? Yeah, Dad, you obeyed God. I said, well, would you have rather me disobeyed him? No. And I'll never get Larry said, no, but we don't have to like it. That's exactly what he said. No, Dad, we don't want you to disobey God. That doesn't mean we have to like it. And then I said to them, I said, God is going to do something great in both of your lives if you'll surrender and give him 2 years. Surrender and give him 2 years. That's all I'm asking. And I promise you, 2 years from now, you will be able to tell a story of what God did in your life. So sometime in the next week, individually, and I don't know how or when, but they each came to their moment of surrender. And they, at some point over the next month, they told me, okay, Dad, I've surrendered. Their attitudes radically changed. Our family became peaceable again. And at the 2 year mark, August of 2014, I took the four of us, me and Dana and Haley and Larry, I took them to Red Lobster with one purpose in mind. I got to tell you this, and lunch is at noon, and if you need to slip out, I'm 2 minutes over time now, but I got to tell you this, it's too cool. At this point, Emmanuel is back to health. We've started to hire staff. We're making budget. I've gotten my first raise, and I mean, we're starting to remodel things, and it's still a nail biter every week, but we can see the light at the end of the tunnel, okay? But for Larry, Larry at this point has bought a car. He's got a job. He's saved a good bit of money. He's decided God's given clarity to get a business degree. He has reconnected with his junior high girlfriend, Mariah, who's now his wife. So his whole life just locked in and in ways that happened because we were in Connecticut. It's really cool, all the backstory I can't tell you. Haley, on the other hand, now she has great friends. She's loving school. She's playing volleyball. She loves her teachers. She's built great relationships. And our thing as dad and daughter has become, used to be as a family, we went to Disneyland. Now our thing as dad and daughter, we go an hour to a train, we get on a train, and in one more hour, we are at Grand Central, and we walk the city, we go to dinner, we shop, and we go to Broadway. And we do this a couple times a year, just me and Haley, just dad and Haley. And I surprise her. I go over to school, and I break the rules, and I get her out of school at 11 o'clock, and she's like, what are we doing? And I go change, I got a surprise. And she's like, oh, I hope we're going to the city. And she jumps in the car, and I start driving south towards Stamford, and sure enough, she knows we're going to the city, you know. And so, I don't know, 3 or 4 months after that Red Lobster time, we're in the city, we're walking, we're kind of bundled up, it's late fall. She's got her arm in mine, she is like a sponge in the city, she just loves it. She loves the smell, she loves the sounds, she loves the contemporary and the old and all the blend of culture, and she loves the food, and she looks at me and she just shivers almost with delight. She goes, I love New York City. And we were getting ready to go see Newsies, which was a Disney Broadway filled with 20-year-old young men, which she loves, you know. And like, what am I thinking, taking my 13-year-old daughter to see this? It was all good and clean, but the opening scene, all these 20-year-old guys are singing. She's going, you know, it was kind of funny. And she hates it when I bring it up. But I stopped in that moment, and I looked at her. And right on the sidewalk by, you know, 34th Street by Macy's. And I said, and Jesus knew you would. And I said, this is his gift to you for accepting his will to move to Connecticut. And at Red Lobster that night, I said to them, hey, guys, it's been 2 years. 2 years. And I asked you to surrender and you surrendered. I said, so let me ask you, what would you change? What would you undo now that it's been 2 years? And they both said, they kind of laughed and they put their heads down like, okay, dad's right, but we don't want to admit it, you know? And they both said, okay, dad, we wouldn't change anything because God's done great things the last 2 years for us. So what I would say is just don't give up, you know, and keep putting God where he should be.